Well, for the last week or so, I have been trying, best governor can do, I suppose, to take leave of the state and official Russia and journey briefly with you somewhere downward into society. And last week we looked at some of the folkways by which Russians acquire goods, organize their lives, and all the rest. The most dramatic, I suppose, expression of unofficial opinion in the Soviet Union in the last 10 or 15 years has been the development of dissident opinion. People who courageously, with little concern for their own safety, come forward, speak openly to Western reporters, write uncensored manuscripts which they circulate in the country, pass abroad to be published. And that so-called samizdat, or uncensored philosophical and political writing, I want to talk about next time. But I want to remind you that public opinion in the Soviet Union is no more anti-Soviet than, by its nature, than, say, American public opinion. That is to say that a lot of public opinion is simply grumbling, discontent of a lesser nature than something akin to overthrowing the political system. And that if we had to generalize about what public opinion really cares about in the Soviet Union, what are the main features of public opinion, I would say it's composed largely of three things, but it's a semi-educated guess. One, a belief that the state should take care of people from the time they're born to the time they die. Cradle to grave welfareism. The state to furnish everything you need from the beginning to the end. I think welfareism has become a central part of public opinion. Secondly, Russian nationalism or Soviet patriotism infused with a deep belief in the validity of national defense. It may surprise all of us to hear that ordinary Russians care about national defense, but after all, they have been invaded. They were invaded terribly in 1941. They lost 20 to 30 million people. The country was totally unprepared. So there's a kind of contract between the government and the people. This will not happen again. We have all the weapons we need. And you get a lot of saber rattling that the Americans dare not do this because we've got all these missiles and they wouldn't dare put a step on a Soviet soil. I think that's important, ordinary Russians. And then, and I speak now only of the Russians and not of the other national group, there is the dramatic revival of what appears to be religiosity in the Soviet Union, particularly belief in old Orthodox Russian religion. It's difficult to know how authentic that is. It seems to me that the outward manifestations of religiosity, which are mainly take the form of wearing a crucifix, can be simply cultural, in the sense that these were nice artistic items in the 19th century. Nothing like it exists except a picture of a space astronaut or a picture of Brezhnev or Andropov to put on your dress. So why not wear a cross? It could simply be culture. And to a certain extent, it's just a fad. Young people begin to do it. Other young people begin to do it. And what do they really believe in religion? I don't know. I never forget, and I think it was back as early as the 60s, walking down the main shopping fair of Moscow and seeing a young woman, I'd say early 20s, it was a summer day, walking along in a T-shirt with this great, bold Russian cross around a chain on her neck. And written on the T-shirt in French was, "Will you sleep with me tonight?" Now, it seems clear to me that some wayward American tourist had given this girl this T-shirt, telling her it said, you know, "I love communism" or something. And she was walking up and down the street with the cross. But both of those items represented a kind of cultural statement on her part. Foreign language on the T-shirt, didn't matter what it said. And a crucifix. So if it's religiosity, I don't know. But there are supposed to be 40 million believers in the Soviet Union, which is a lot of religion in any country. Now, these are more formal aspects of Soviet public opinion, but there are two other aspects of Soviet public opinion you ought to know about. First of all, most opinion in the Soviet Union passes, because it is a censored society, in two rather unusual ways, or at least unusual for us. One is through the so-called rumor mill. That is to say, because news, there's a kind of blackout on hard news in the Soviet Union, word-of-mouth stories about what's going on abroad, or even in the country, are fabulous in the fullest sense of the word. For example, they don't report crime, as a rule, on Soviet television or Soviet radios or in the newspapers. Therefore, there are wondrous stories about the degrees of crime and the monstrosity of those crimes being committed in a city like Moscow that pass in the form of rumors. I remember vividly one morning, very early, arriving at an apartment of friends and being told that a woman had been raped in one of the outlying parks, public parks of Moscow the night before. By noon, when I arrived at somebody else's house, it turned out that 30 women had been raped at various parks across Moscow. And by that night, at around 10 o'clock, as the vodka flows, in all seriousness, there was a story that there was a marauding gang of prison convicts in Moscow, in the streets, and women were being raped everywhere, and nobody should go out. And you know, it was generally believed. I told you the classic story of self-fulfilling rumor that in 1977, when the Soviet Union published the new official census, it showed what for Russians were exceedingly racist people, an alarming statistic, namely that the Russian population was declining. The birth rate was about zero. And the Turkic, non-Russian, non-Caucasian, Asian people of the Soviet Union, their birth rate was growing dramatically. They were having four kids per couple. And then by the year 2000, those Turkic people would be the majority in the Soviet Union. The word immediately went out, you may remember this story, the word immediately went out that therefore the Soviet government was taking all the male contraceptives out of Russia and sending them down to the Turkic republics. All right, well, this caused an immediate run on the contraceptive shops. All Russian men immediately raced out to buy gross after gross of contraceptive. And the result was is that within a week, it had become a self-fulfilling prophecy. That is to say, there were no contraceptives in Russia any longer. They had all been bought. So, now, the other widespread form of communication, of stating opinion in the Soviet Union, is what is known in Russia as the anecdote, or the anecdote, which is not exactly what we would call a joke. It's more a kind of story that's meant to convey an astute political or social commentary. And since you all have worked so hard on the unserious parts of Soviet politics this semester, you can put down your pens, and I will try to take you on a serious journey, at least briefly, into Soviet society through the mirrors of some Soviet anecdotes that have come my way in recent years. You ought to know a few things about the anecdote, because it is a serious matter in a kind of laughing sort of way. First of all, under Stalin, there was actually a law that said if you told an anecdote with an anti-Soviet complexion, and virtually all have some critical complexion, it was 10 years in the camps. There was actually a law. That even led to an anecdote that was very brief, that when Stalin and Churchill met during the war, Churchill innocently mentioned that in the United States that lots of people told jokes about him. And he said, in fact, I have a whole book full. And Stalin said, that's nothing. I got several campfuls. Well, it's no longer dangerous to tell anecdotes in the Soviet Union. And the really interesting thing is that everybody tells them. Ordinary citizens like us, as well as high party leaders. I have heard anecdotes from dissidents, from ordinary Soviet citizens who don't care about politics at all, to party secretaries who said, have you heard this anecdote? It has become a kind of accepted way to communicate. If you're friendly with somebody and you see them on the street, in the Soviet Union, instead of giving them high fives, you say, have you heard the latest anecdote? I mean, that's a sign of intimacy. You're ready to confide and to pass along some good humor or a good story. And so people tell it without fear. Secondly, anecdotes deal with virtually every aspect of Soviet life. It is really a kind of phenomenon. I once played a game with Soviet friends, a variation of the old American game. I would name a subject, and they had to tell an anecdote on the subject. And anything you could think of. Foreign affairs, domestic affairs, goods, politics, history, and they always came forth with an anecdote. Where they come from is a subject of enormous speculation, both on the part of philosophers and on the part of the KGB. And there are various theories. But one thing is clear, they are created very, very quickly. I recall, for example, living in Moscow at a time when there was a great rash of defecting Soviet musicians who were defecting to the United States. And so immediately there was a new anecdote in the Soviet Union. What is a Soviet trio? Soviet trio is a Soviet quartet returning from abroad. So, 24 hours, at most, that was circulating after the report had come on Voice of America. Now, not all Soviet anecdotes are meaningful to us, partly because some of them are so embedded not only in actual Russian language that they don't translate, but in the Russian way of speaking that you can't really replicate them. Let me give you an example of one that doesn't translate so you'll see what I mean. Brezhnev, who acquired the reputation in his late years as a kind of ventriloquist dummy, who was incapable of pronouncing on his own and everything was written down for him, allegedly was addressing the Party Congress, the most august body of the Soviet Communist Party, and he began his speech as follows. It's hard in English. In Russian, Дорогие товарищи империалисты, in English, Dear Comrade Imperialists. Everybody looks around. Everybody looks around the hall. What can he be saying? He's baffled. He hears the murmur, so he starts again. Dear Comrade Imperialists. Now the hall's in an uproar. He's calling on the prayer. What can it mean? So with this, Andropov, you know, comes over like this, whispers into Brezhnev's ear, points to the page, but clears his voice. Dear comrades, imperialists are taking over the world. Well, you forgot the comma. Now, the play on the comma, the hesitation, the way Russian words read together, leaves Russians in hysterics when they hear this joke. The real problem, though, is that anecdotes, think of it like this. In the United States, I suppose most American jokes are about sex, which probably tells us something about our problems. In the Soviet Union, almost all anecdotal humor is about politics and society, which tell you something about their problems. And you can judge which is the worst set of problems, I guess. The point is, the Soviet anecdote is embedded in the history of the Soviet Union, in society, in the everyday life, and therefore for those of us who've never lived there, never lived there long enough, it's a little bit hard to understand. But the point is, anecdote's first purpose is not to be funny. It's to be true. And that's a big difference. That's why it's not specifically a joke. When somebody tells you a wondrously good anecdote, you're not at first supposed to laugh hysterically, but you're supposed to say exactly, or how true. And that's the triumph of an anecdote. And then comes the laughter. The truth is that life, however miserable in the Soviet Union, is sometimes funny in a kind of surrealistic way. I remember being invited once in New York to hear a defected Soviet army captain give a speech, and I arrived late, and just as I arrived, I heard him say, "And so we painted the grass green." And I thought he must have just told a fabulous anecdote. So I asked the guy, being a collector of anecdotes next to me, I heard the punchline, what was the joke? He said it wasn't a joke. He was explaining that most of the time, the job of his squadron was to paint the grass at the military base green, so that when the inspecting officers came, the place looked good. That's fairly funny when you think about it. I mean, it's not something we think of the military doing. On the other hand, life in the Soviet Union sometimes imitates anecdotes. Again, Brezhnev, there was an anecdote that circulated in the 70s that he was so dumb that he once gave a 2-hour speech in 4 hours because accidentally he read the carbon copy as well. Believe it or not, true story, in 1978, there was a report that was verified that Brezhnev had gone to some party congress and read the wrong speech. And he didn't realize it until he was midway through the speech, turned to his secretary, who pulled out the right speech, gave it to him. He simply cleared his voice and started all over again. And so you get, you know, mirror image. If you've lived in the Soviet Union, or if you've studied the Soviet Union, or you've read about it, then you understand that anecdotes are expressions of ethos. They tell you something that was going on or is going on in a way that isn't permissible, for example, in the press. I told you, I think, the story about the terror, just to remind ourselves of how terrible it once was to live in the Soviet Union in the 30s, in the late 30s. People literally were afraid to go to bed at night, particularly political people. They were absolutely convinced that they were going to be arrested. Millions were. And so a habit developed where the male political member of the family would pack a bag before he went to bed at night so that when they came for him, he would be ready. And one night, the household of this one party secretary, 3 o'clock in the morning, the police always came the knock. And he got up and he kissed his wife and his kids goodbye. He took his bag and he went downstairs. And he came back 30 seconds later and his wife said, "What is it?" And he said, "Oh, it's nothing. The house is on fire." Well, you'd have to live in a terrorized society to think that was really funny, but above all true. And oddly enough, suddenly in the Soviet Union, the last 2 or 3 months, there is a modern day version of that. You recall that when Andropov came to power, he announced a new campaign for labor discipline. If you weren't at work on time, you were in big trouble. Big trouble. And he made a big point of scapegoating some high factory directors who were showing up at 10 o'clock in the morning instead of 9. So the following anecdote, which is a variant of this old one, immediately began to circulate. 10 o'clock in the morning, and the factory director had not arrived at work. There's panic in his office. What if Andropov finds out? So the deputy director goes into the back room and secretly calls the home of the director. The director's wife answers. He says, "May I speak to the comrade director?" She says, "I regret to inform you that the comrade director died last night." The guy says, "Thank God, I thought he was late to work." Well, you get the point. My own favorite anecdote, story, that grows out of the Stalin era is the following, because it conveys a combination of what is terrible and what is actually funny. Stalin is addressing a party meeting, and in the middle of his speech, somebody does the unforgivable. He sneezes. Stalin stops, looks around the room, and asks simply, "Who sneezed?" Not a word. He turns to the secret police squad and he says, "Shoot the first row." Stalin says, "Who sneezed?" "Shoot the second row." Stalin says, "Comrades, who sneezed?" "Comrades, who sneezed?" Finally, in the back of the room, a little man raises his hand. "Comrade Stalin, I sneezed." Stalin says, "Good. Gesundheit, comrade." At the midst of the terror, as it had resumed after World War II, when the terror had become really terrible, and particularly the level of torture in the prisons had become very high, the Soviet Union entered on an official campaign that could only be called chauvinistic. It was claimed in the Soviet Union that the Soviet Union had discovered, invented, found everything ever known to the world. Everything. Telephone, telegraph, anything. Russia first. And so the following story circulated. Three Russian scientists down in the southern Asiatic part of Russia discovered a mummy. They believed that the mummy was the remains of Genghis Khan. This could have been the greatest archaeological discovery of the 20th century. And so they wired Stalin in the Kremlin. "We believe we may have found the remains of Genghis Khan. We need further confirmation through scientific methods. We'll inform." Stalin cables back, "I am elated. This will put Russia first in the world in science. Please inform immediately." No answer comes from the scientists. For a month, Stalin cables back, "I demand to have confirmation immediately." They cable back, "But comrade Stalin, our scientific methods are not yet exact enough to make positive confirmation." Stalin cables back, "I must have confirmation immediately or it will be your head." A week passes, the telegram comes back to Moscow, "We have confirmed beyond a shadow of a doubt that the mummy is the remains of Genghis Khan." They're brought to Moscow. It's blazoned in the press. They get all these medals, the Stalin Prize. They're heralded across the Soviet Union. And as they leave the banquet, one of their colleagues says to them, "Tell me, how in the world, given the level of scientific inquiry, were you able to confirm beyond a shadow of a doubt that the mummy was in fact the remains of Genghis Khan?" And the scientist said, "It was simple. The mummy confessed." If you live in the Soviet Union today, and you live decently, or half decently, it is exceedingly unlikely that you can live on your salary, on your official salary. It is impossible, and therefore necessary, to supplement your salary by what Russians call nalyeva, or unofficial enterprises. And therefore, there's a whole bunch of proverbs that are less than anecdotes, but meant to be truthful statements. For example, the worst curse that you can level at your enemy is not your mama or something like that, but may you always have to live on your salary. If you know anything about the inefficiency of the Soviet planning system, you will understand fully this following story. A foolish, pompous party secretary in some little tiny town up in northern cold Siberia decided that it was a grave sin that the town did not have in the square a gigantic monument to Lenin. There was not a single granite monument to Lenin in the town, so he ordered one to be built. Something familiar, something well known. And so the order went into process, and one day the factory manager, the party secretary, went down to the monument building factory to see how the monument was coming along, and it looked terrific. They were working on the head of Lenin, except that he noticed one thing, being an astute political figure, that Lenin was bald, and Lenin was wearing no hat. And it's exceedingly cold in Siberia. He says, this cannot be. Comrade Lenin will not stand in our town without a cap. Put a cap on his head. So they put a cap on his head, and came the day of the unveiling, and they unveiled the monument, and there was Lenin. One cap on his head and the other in his hand. Well, The reason this is funny to Russians is perhaps the most famous monument to Lenin is Lenin, when he comes back from the Finland station in 1917 to denounce the provisional government, he's making a speech. He had one of these soft cloth caps, and he had it in his hand, and he was waving it in the air for emphasis. And so there's a famous statue all over the Soviet Union with Lenin standing like this with his cap, and now he's got a cap. You should also know that the telling of most anecdotes takes place over the kitchen table. There are a few nightclubs, few night spots of any sort, little high-quality, accessible culture at night in Russia. And therefore, most Russians base their social life in their kitchen at night. Friends come over, and that means to drink vodka. And as most of you know, there is a kind of epidemic of vodka drinking, even drunkenness, and maybe even extreme alcoholism in the Soviet Union. It's a serious problem. But many, many, many anecdotes are a kind that reflect, well, they are about vodka to begin with, lots and lots of anecdotes, but they also reflect a kind of what you might call vodka inventiveness, that a truly serious Russian drinker sees vodka in everything. For example, in 1967, the Soviet government minted a beautiful silver ruble coin. It was really beautifully done. And as usual, it had on the coin a familiar picture of Lenin pointing to victory, standing like this. But every serious vodka drinker knew what that coin really meant, because if you look carefully, you could see that Lenin was pointing to 11 o'clock when the vodka shops opened. And therefore, for the next few years, if you were ready to drink in the morning at 11 a.m., you simply took your silver ruble out, held it up, and says, Comrade Lenin says it's time to drink. And off people went. It wasn't what the Soviet government had in mind. Don't think, though, to be fair, that all Soviet anecdotes are anti-Soviet. Many are, but not all are. Some just express grumbling and even cynicism. For example, I once tried to find out, because I once had an idea that I would collect these things and do something with them. It never came to anything, but I wanted to find out what was the oldest Soviet anecdote, the very first one ever recorded or heard. And it seems to me that the first, at least the one that I could find that seems to me to have been the first, was not really anti-Soviet, but just cynical. And probably most of you know it. It says, what is the difference between capitalism and socialism? The difference is that under capitalism, you have the exploitation of man by man. And under socialism, it's the other way around. Well, That seems to me to be cynical rather than anti-Soviet. On the other hand, there are anti-Soviet anecdotes, and probably the oldest and most famous one goes back to the debate in the 1920s about the building of socialism in one country. You remember that Marx had said and Trotsky had argued that you can't build socialism in one country. It's an international phenomenon, so you've got to wait for the International Revolution. Stalin said, no, comrades, because Russia is a large country, we can build socialism in the Soviet Union. And in fact, that became the official line. It was announced socialism was built, and thereupon came the anecdote. Comrades, we have discovered that it is in fact possible to build socialism in one large country. But comrades, is it possible to build socialism in one small country? Say, Switzerland. And the answer is, of course. But what have you got against the Swiss? All right, that's anti-Soviet. That is anti-Soviet. But then there are some anecdotes that are utterly convinced that life is bad in the Soviet Union, but it is actually worse elsewhere. For example, when Khrushchev was in power, there was still, briefly, the famous alliance between China and the Soviet Union. And one day, Mao Zedong, the leader of China, sent the following cable to Khrushchev. Comrade Khrushchev, Chinese people are starving. Send food. Khrushchev cabled back, Soviet food in short supply. Tighten belts. Mao cabled back, send belts. No matter how bitter a Soviet citizen is, no matter how badly they live, they are utterly convinced that life in China is worse. It's the one hope to go on. Good, I'm glad it's worse in China. One Soviet citizen said to me, and he wasn't even kidding, I hope it gets worse here in Russia, then it'll be still worse in China. Russians hate Poles and they hate Chinese, so they've got the following story. One Pole says to another Pole, if you could have anything in the world you wanted, what would it be? And the other Pole says, I wish to God that the Chinese would invade Poland 3 times. The other Pole says, you want the Chinese to invade Poland 3 times? That would be terrible for Poland. And the Pole says, sure, it would be terrible for Poland, but think of it, they'd have to cross Russia 6 times. Leaders. Russia loves their leaders, her leaders. Every leader has produced a kind of camp or album of anecdotes. Some terrible, some funny, some not quite so exuberant. We all remember the Stalin cult. Most Russians alive today remember it very well. It was an extraordinary cult. You know what extremes it went to. Thus came about the following story, set in heaven. It turned out that God was depressed. He didn't go about his holy work. He just lay in bed all day and moped. St. Peter grew alarmed. He didn't know what to do. So he called for Dr. Sigmund Freud, who was in heaven. And he said, Freud, I'm worried about God. He just mopes around all day. I don't know what's wrong with him. Will you have a look at him? Freud said, I'll do what I can. So Freud conducts a series of intensive psychoanalytical sessions with God, and he returns to St. Peter with a grave look on his face. St. Peter says, it's bad, is it, Dr. Freud? Freud says, it is serious. God is suffering from delusions of grandeur. He thinks he's Stalin. Lenin, on the other hand, the cult of Lenin today is a kind of combination of benign, avuncular, not very terrifying nonsense. And that gave rise then to a well-known anecdote about Lenin and the Lenin cult. Turns out that just after Andropov became the General Secretary of the Communist Party, he received from Poland an invitation to visit there officially the Polish Communist Party. Well, you know, the Polish Communist Party has been in deep, deep, deep trouble in recent years. And Andropov thought he should go to reaffirm Soviet support for the Polish Communist Party. But the question came up in the Politburo. It is always tradition to take some highly significant gift. What could the Soviet leadership send with Andropov to the Polish Communist Party? Had to be something really significant, something that symbolized the unity of the two communist parties. And as they're sitting around the Politburo, finally one Politburo member remembered that Lenin, before the revolution, had lived in Poland. And since there are statues all over the Soviet Union, you know, Lenin passed this way, Lenin bought his cigarettes here, Lenin used to read a newspaper in this park, and there's a monument there everywhere Lenin was, why not commission a wondrously significant painting, big painting, commemorating Lenin in Poland, and let it be called Lenin in Poland. And Andropov could take it to the Poles. Oh, everybody hopes, sensational idea. This is fabulous. One problem. One member who's in charge of culture points out that the Poles are a little more Western than we are. They're a little more avant-garde, modernistic in their artistic taste. So we can't send them any of this Soviet socialist realism. We got to send something with a little piaz to it. Who can do it? Ah, says Andropov. Well, I remember when I was the head of the KGB, we arrested this Jewish painter. It's always a Jewish painter. We arrested this Jewish painter. He was very modernistic. He's still down in the police cell. We can get him up here. He'll do it. They bring this guy in. They explain to him, Lenin in Poland, something very significant that the Poles will understand, something that will bond the friendship. Can you do it? Jewish painter, can do. No problem. I see it already, he says. I visualize it. Good. They said, just be sure you're back here in 2 weeks. When Comrade Andropov leaves for Poland. 2 weeks pass, 10 minutes before Andropov's to go to the airport, in comes this Jewish painter with this gigantic canvas covered with a sheet and his two assistants. He races into the room. They put the canvases about from here to the in the office down. They pull the sheet off. And there sees Andropov in the Politburo in stunned disbelief. A naked man and a naked woman screwing. Andropov says, shit. Don't know. What in the hell is that? Andropov says, who the hell is that woman? And the Jewish painter says, well, that's Krupskaya, Lenin's wife. Oh, says Andropov. Well, who's that man? Jewish painter says, well, that's Trotsky. Andropov says, where the hell is Lenin? The painter says, Lenin's in Poland. The anecdote inventors had a problem with Khrushchev. Personally, I find Khrushchev endlessly fascinating. Russians were really put off by him. On the one hand, they respected what Jews call his chutzpah. I mean, he'd say and do almost anything. On the other hand, they always have felt that he was embarrassing the country with his kind of primitive behavior, taking his shoe off and banging it at the UN, all that sort of stuff. And, I mean, they took to calling him because he was interested in the growing of corn, old cornhead. And, I mean, they were sort of... So there weren't many exciting anecdotes about Khrushchev, but there was one that everybody repeated, so I give it to you simply so you'll know how they felt about Khrushchev. A man one day suddenly bolts out of a car, runs across Red Square, and at the top of his lungs shouts, Khrushchev is a fool! Khrushchev is a fool! Khrushchev is a fool! And the KGB race out, and they wrestle him to the ground, they take him off, and the guy got 10 years. He got 5 years for disturbing the peace, and 5 years for betraying a state secret. Now, the big problem, though, is Brezhnev. The big problem is Brezhnev. Brezhnev became the source of endless anecdotes. Why? Because Brezhnev was widely believed to be the Jerry Ford of Soviet politics. Now, as I was thinking about this last night, I suddenly realized that not all of you are old enough to remember how Chevy Chase began his career. On Saturday Night Live, doing pratfalls of Jerry Ford getting in and out of helicopters. But some of you remember this. For those of you who don't, I remember one thing in particular. That Jerry Ford, in Chevy Chase's presentation, went to scratch his head, and he accidentally poked himself in the eye. And the Secret Service, four of them, came over and wrestled the offending finger to the ground. So, this is roughly the picture of Brezhnev in the Soviet Union while he was alive. Now, after all, the man has gone on to join the majority. To a certain extent, it would be disrespectful to repeat Soviet anecdotes told when he was alive. So let us simply, in pointing these out to you, call them the memorial Leonid Brezhnev anecdote. Brezhnev was thought to be relentlessly, incurably stupid. And therefore, almost every anecdote is a variation on his towering stupidity. It was known, for example, that he loved riddles. But he can never solve one. One day, late in his life, Brezhnev is walking down the Kremlin corridor, and he runs into Andropov. And Andropov, who always wants to humor the old guy, says, "Leonid, want to hear a riddle?" Chernenko says, sure, Lonya. Tell me the riddle. Brezhnev says, "Who is the son of my father, but not me?" Chernenko says, "I don't know who." Brezhnev says, "Andropov's brother." The next week, Brezhnev goes to India to have a conference with Madame Gandhi. He returns to the Soviet Union 3 days later. He calls the Politburo on the stage. He says, "Comrades, I have decided to have a dot painted on my forehead." So they pass a resolution. Okay, give him his dot. So they bring in... They bring in the dot painter, and they paint this dot on his forehead, and Brezhnev is sitting there. And he says to the Politburo, "How do you like it?" They say, "It's kind of nice, but why'd you have it painted there?" He said, "I'll tell you why. When I was in India, I was having a very serious conversation with Indira Gandhi, and at one point she looked at me and she said, 'You know, Brezhnev, you're missing something right here.'" The following week, Brezhnev became deeply alarmed about the fact that the Americans had landed on the moon, thereby surpassing the Soviet space program. He thought and he thought, and he came up with a brilliant idea to catch up with and pass by the American space program. He summoned the Soviet astronauts to his office and he said, "Comrades, I have a plan. They will teach the Americans a lesson. We will land on the sun." The astronaut said, "Gee, I don't know. We burn up." And Brezhnev says, "You think I'm stupid? We'll land at night." In 1980, Brezhnev had to address the opening of the Olympic Committee. He began his speech. He looked at Andropov. Andropov comes over. He was reading that. Toward the end of his life, the Brezhnev cult grew in the Soviet press, and it was rather sweet, I must say. And almost every time they mentioned Brezhnev in the Soviet press, they would always refer to him as "Dear Leonid Ilyich," Leonid being his first name and Ilyich being his middle name, which is the polite way you address a Russian. It would always be, "Today, dear Leonid Ilyich said this." And it got so pervasive that it was rumored that now when Brezhnev answered the telephone, he would say, "Hello, dear Leonid Ilyich speaking." It's possible. Of course, maybe the most inventive source of anecdotes is everyday life in the Soviet Union, the quality of the life, which leaves a lot to be desired. There's a lot of discussion about the quality of their life versus, say, the quality of American life. And Pravda is forever going on about how Americans are really at the abyss, that we are standing on the edge of the abyss about to collapse. And so one day, the following question was asked. "Is it true, comrades, that the American people are standing on the edge of the economic abyss?" To which the anecdotal answer is, "Comrades, it is absolutely true. The American people are standing there, looking down to see how we live." Some Russians are endlessly... Does everybody have to leave at 2:20? No. Some Russians are endlessly inventive. It's not 2:20 yet, but I'm just looking ahead. About combining commentary on their life with international affairs. detente. Brezhnev and Nixon. Brezhnev is invited to the United States. He's told by Nixon he can see anything he wants, even the Pentagon. He says, I'd like to see the Pentagon. They take him to the Pentagon, and he gets a thorough tour of the Pentagon. But as he's leaving, he sees a red door locked. He says, I want to see that red door, he says to the general. The general says, no, you can't. That's top secret. He says, Dick Nixon said, I can see anything, and I want to see it. All right. The general opens it up, and there in this room is nothing but a table with a red telephone on it. Brezhnev says, what is that? The general says, that is a telephone to hell. Brezhnev says, get out of here. No, it's true. Brezhnev says, wow. Can I try it? The general says, sure. Brezhnev picks up the phone, and he hears the voice, hello, this is the devil speaking. He hangs up the phone. He says, that's amazing. And as he's walking out of the room, the American general says, but Sherman Brezhnev, that'll be $50. Brezhnev says, oh, well, it's expensive, but it was worth it. He gives him the $50, goes back to the embassy, immediately races back to Moscow on his jet, gets into the Kremlin, calls all his generals, and he says, you fools! The Americans got something we don't got. They got a telephone to hell. So the general says, Comrade Brezhnev, we've had that for years. He just never asked about it. Brezhnev says, I want to see it. They take him down to the Soviet Pentagon, goes down the same corridor, same red door, they unlock it, there's the telephone. Brezhnev says, wonderful, can I try it? Picks up the phone, voice, hello, this is the devil speaking. Hangs it. Says, that's absolutely wonderful. He's walking out the door, the Soviet general says, Comrade Brezhnev, that'll be 2 kopecks. Brezhnev says, wait a minute, how come it costs $50 in the United States and only 2 kopecks here? General says, because here's a local call. Russian women are forever commenting on the difficulties they face not only in obtaining fine goods, say lingerie, but getting them clean. There's virtually no reliable dry cleaning in the Soviet Union. Gives rise to all sorts of commentary about the condition of Soviet women and their fineries. For example, Soviet women like to ask the following question. How many pair of fine panties does an American woman have? Obviously, an American woman has 7. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. How many pair does a French woman have? 6. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Thursday, her lover comes. She doesn't need any. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Clear. How many does a Russian woman have? A Russian woman has 12 pair of fine pants. January, February, March. It's a little cruel. Access to culture is highly prized. How do you get a ticket to a play that you've waited to see for 2 years? Such a play as Master and Margarita, which has been running in Moscow for about 3 years. People wait for years to get a ticket. There has never in its history been seen an empty seat in the house. One night, the curtain is falling, is open, his lights dim. Man notices a woman sitting next to him, and next to her is an empty seat. He turns to the woman, he says, isn't that amazing? An empty seat at Master and Margarita. She says, yes, it's an empty seat, and it's a terrible story. That seat was for my husband. We bought these 2 tickets 2 years ago, and 2 days ago, he died. The man said, gosh, that's terrible, but surely you could have given one of the tickets to one of his friends. And she says, oh, no, they're all at the funeral. Sorry. Some Soviet citizens, bitch, 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 bitch. Suddenly one day, a guy shows up, going around Moscow with a notebook, keeping a record of what they ain't got anywhere in Moscow. He goes into a bread store. No bread. Comes out, he writes down, no bread. Poof! And he spits. Goes to a clothing store, wants to buy a pair of pants. No pants. Gets out his book, writes down, no pants. Poof! Goes to a bookstore to buy an edition of Pushkin. No Pushkin. Gets out his number. No Pushkin. Poof! Finally, the KGB's had enough. They pick him up. The guy figures he's through. They're going to take him down and shoot him. They take him downtown. They give him a lecture. They tell him to get out and don't let it happen again. He gets on the street, pulls out his book. He writes down, no bullets. Volodya Gorfenko told me today, he just heard on the radio, that the Soviet Union this morning passed a resolution to change its national symbol, emblem, from the hammer and the sickle to Cupid, the doll of love. And the political reason as follows, that Cupid is a better representation of the nature of the Soviet Union. Bare-assed, but heavily armed. Why do secret policemen always travel in threes? All Soviet citizens know the answer to this. One can read. One can write. And the other is there to keep an eye on these two dangerous intellectuals. Alcoholism and detente. Nixon and Brezhnev appealed to the darker sides of each other's personality, and thereby came detente, in my theory. One night, Nixon is in Moscow drinking vodka with Brezhnev, and he says, "You know, Leonid, I hear you got lots of drunks on the street in Moscow, a lot of Soviet drunks." Brezhnev says, "It's a lie. It's an utter lie, Dick. We don't have any drunks on the street in Moscow." Nixon says, "I don't believe it." Brezhnev says, "I tell you what I'll do. I'll give you a gun. I'll take in my private limousine. We'll drive everywhere in Moscow. You see one drunk, you can shoot him." Ah, Nixon likes this. He said, "This is good." As he goes to get his coat, Brezhnev calls up the KGB. He says, "Round up all the drunks." He and Nixon get in the car. They drive all over Moscow. There are hours, in the wee hours of the morning, not a drunk in sight. Nixon has gone into one of his classic depressions. He's not getting his way. He's in an absolute funk by now. No sign. And just as they're coming back to the criminal, he's about to give it up. Suddenly there's this one drunk stumbling along that the KGB has missed. Nixon rolls down the window, aims his rifle, blows the drunk away. He is really happy. Brezhnev is utterly depressed. Nixon goes back to Moscow. A year later, Brezhnev shows up in... Nixon goes back to Washington. A year later, Brezhnev shows up in Washington. Second trip of detente. "Dick, you remember that night in Moscow?" "Oh, I remember it well. It was wonderful." Brezhnev says, "My intelligence people tell me you got plenty of your own drunks right here in Washington on the street at night." Says Nixon, "Ridiculous. Ridiculous. We don't have such a problem." Brezhnev says, "I want the same deal. The limo, the gun, the works." Nixon says, "You got it." Brezhnev gets his coat. Nixon calls up the FBI. "Get all the drunks off the street." 1 o'clock in the morning, they go out prowling in Nixon's limousine. They drive all over Washington. Not one lousy drunk. Brezhnev is really depressed now. Finally, they're heading down Washington Avenue, back to Pennsylvania Avenue, back to the White House. And suddenly, over in the corner is a loud, boisterous group of about 10 drunks. I mean, they are staggering all over the place. They can barely walk. They're falling down. Brezhnev gleefully rolls down the window, takes aim, and kills all 10 of them. He is happy. Next day, Washington Post, headline: "Fanatic assassinates entire staff of Soviet embassy." We're coming to the end. Many Soviet citizens are deeply, deeply perplexed and troubled about the Soviet Union's ventures in the Third World. They cannot relate to Third World countries. They have racist attitudes toward them. They think these Third World countries are draining Russian resources, which gave rise recently to the following story. The Soviet Union finally found itself a small country with a small communist party in power in Africa that would be its ally in Africa. And the Soviet Union was very happy. And on the day before the Soviet Union was to sign a treaty with this country, a wire came from the Communist Party of this African country. "Dear esteemed Russian comrades, we regret to inform you that last night, uncivilized cannibals ate your ambassador. Please do not take this personally, and feel free..." Sorry. "And feel free to eat ours." Finally, immigration. Immigration. 300,000 Soviet citizens, mainly Jews, but not only, left the Soviet Union in the 1970s, became the major source of comment for many people. Imagine people leaving the Soviet Union. Gave rise to two stories. One was that the Soviet Union was having trouble with language training programs in the Soviet Union. They simply couldn't find enough skilled language teachers to teach all the languages of the world and the Soviet Union. So the Politburo passed a resolution. Henceforth, the Soviet Union would only teach two languages. Hebrew for those who are leaving. and Chinese for those who are staying. Don't get it. All right. Soviet Union is deeply afraid of China. There are dozens and dozens of anecdotes built on the premise that in the year 2000, the Soviet Union no longer exists and that China now occupies Soviet territory. Immigration. Final story. Really an uplifting one in a way. The day that Andropov was elected General Secretary, it was a struggle. The Central Committee vote was divided, but he got it. He went to bed that night and he slept fitfully. He was so excited to be the leader of the Soviet Union. Woke up the next morning early and he threw open the windows of his Kremlin apartment. He looked out the window and he noticed something that's unusual in Moscow. It happens only about 75 days of the year. The sun was shining. There was the sun in the sky. And Andropov, being kind of exuberant guy and excited, said, "Hi, son." And as he turned away, he suddenly heard the sun speak to him. The sun said, "Good morning, Comrade Andropov. And a glorious good morning to you, the new leader of the Soviet Communist Party, and to the entire Central Committee." Andropov was amazed. He knew he was going to be a good leader, but this was fast. He thought about it during the morning, and at high noon, he raced back to his bedroom. He flung open the windows, and there was the sun, now high in the sky. And he said, "Good afternoon, sun." And lo and behold, the sun said, "Good afternoon, Comrade Andropov, and a glorious good afternoon to you and the entire Soviet Communist Party and its Central Committee." Andropov was persuaded. He summoned all the members of the Central Committee back to Moscow, 362 of them. They came winging in on their private jets. He wanted them to see this. They raced to the Kremlin. He raced with them, all 362 of them, up to his bedroom. It was now 6 o'clock at night. He flung open the window, and there was the sun just beginning to set, and he said, "Hello, sun!" But watch this. "Hello, sun!" And back came, "F*** you, Andropov, I'm in the West now!"